Welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios and the EA Chapter 84 podcast. I'm your host, David Weber. Here in the Northwest, we are deep into our fall wet and cold weather. In addition, the daylight hours are short and getting shorter. But on the upside, this should give you more time to work on those airplane projects and listen to all 8 podcast episodes while you do it. We have a wonderful podcast coming to you right now. In this episode, get to hear from a man who is a shining example of a never give up attitude. He has been someone who I have looked to for advice on several aircraft assembly topics. He was a technical advisor to me all during my planned built Sonics construction, and in many ways a mentor. I'm very honored to bring you my interview with longtime EA Chapter 84 member Jim Davison. Not only does Jim share his early life, but he is very candid about the mistakes he made, which led up to the unfortunate off-airport landing of his Rutan design, Long Easy. The podcast wraps up as I bring you the latest Chapter 84 news, including updates on meetings and the Christmas party. Please, if you're enjoying this podcast and all of the podcasts, hit the thumbs up on your app. But most of all, subscribe so that you will know when a new podcast is available. We'll be right back after a quick break. Welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios. I'm here this week with a good friend of mine, man who did several inspections on my airplane while I was building it, and has been a longtime member of EA Chapter 84, Jim Davison. Welcome to the studios, Jim.
Well, thank you.
So, Jim, let's kind of jump right into the thick and the youth of Jim Davison. Kind of tell our listeners where you grew up.
Okay, I grew up in a small town in Nebraska called Beatrice, about 10,000 people. And so, depending where you're from, it's larger than 600. But it's a wonderful place for kids to grow up because kids had a free rein and really, really hard to get in trouble. I mean, you had to do something really, I mean, nowadays you could do things, you'd take you down to jail now. And those days they'd just slap your hand and say, hey, don't do that anymore, you know.
You were a troublemaker at all.
Well, I'd say that when I grew up, I went to a small school. They called it Belvedere. And it was a 4-room schoolhouse.
Wow.
And they had 2 grades in each room, essentially, for a grade school. And the principal is one of the teachers. You know, low overhead. They didn't have a lot of administration there. And I hate to say mediocre, I was probably a pretty poor student. But I had a hard time all through school that I'd always been accused of not trying very hard. But later on, I found out that I just had dyslexia.
Oh.
Was why I had such a hard problem. But I didn't find that out till I was in the mid-20s, early 30s, you know. But anyway, so I struggled all the way through school. And then when I graduated from high school, I went to college. I kind of wanted to go into chemistry. I didn't realize my problem, but to get these big long names and all these formulas and that, and I'd forget them 15 seconds after I learned them.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to test and that, you know, I just could make it, you know. And so it so happened, though, that my summer after my first semester, first year of college, that I was home and I had a motorcycle. And my good buddy, he had a 40 Ford coupe with a Chevy V8 in it. And we were racing down Main Street once and blasted by the cop. And the
That probably wasn't just a little slap on the wrist, was
it? Well, he didn't chase us.
You're kidding.
But the thing is, no. I got home. He was waiting in the driveway when I got home. And the only thing that crossed me about it is my buddy who had the Ford, you know, he didn't get a ticket or nothing, you know. And I got a ticket for speeding. And then I went down to the judge for the speeding ticket. And the judge says, hey, he says, he didn't clock you. You know, he can't charge you a speeding. And so the judge right on the bench changed that to negligent driving. And that was twice as bad as speeding.
No.
And so I got my license suspended. And so
he didn't do you any favors by doing this.
No. And when I drove a truck during the summer, you know, to make my money. And so without a license, I couldn't drive a truck. I had a bad time in school. So I was kind of unsettled about going back to school. And so I joined the Navy. So in the Navy, during boot camp, you give you a bunch of tests and that. And I decided I'd go into naval aviation. And at the time, I started flying when I was about 18 years old. And so I was kind of interested in the naval aviation.
So you say that you were flying at 18. Was this prior to the Navy?
Yeah, prior to the Navy.
So what airport was this out of?
It was the Beatrice Municipal.
Okay.
And I was flying, learned into a Champ and Tri-Pacer. No. A Champ and a Ronica.
Oh, okay.
Ronica Champ and a Piper.
So both Cub. Tail wheel, both low horsepower.
Yeah, both tail wheel. Yeah. Both the Piper had a 65 in it, and then the Ronica had a 85 in it. And so that's what I learned how to fly. And so after that one, you know, we're flying. I get digressing here, but you always hear about people having a problem with tail draggers. You know, people learn on tricycle gear having a problem with transition. But boy, when you learn on a tail dragger, you know, it's
second
you wonder
nature.
Why does anybody ever have a problem? You know,
yeah.
But at any rate, so when I went in the Navy, I had a opportunity to go be in the NAVCAD, to be a naval aviator. But now
explain what NAVCAD is.
Well, I don't know the acronym, but it's a naval aviation. It's for a non-commissioned officer. You'd be a warrant officer, I believe, when you get done with it. But I decided not to do that because my coordination, my brain muscle coordination was not that responsive. And so I just didn't think that I'd be very successful in a crisis situation. You know, when a crisis hit, you know, you got to respond immediately.
Right.
And I don't respond immediately for a lot of stuff. And so I dropped out of the program.
What year was this?
It was 1959-1961.
Okay.
And then I was a jet mechanic rating. In the Navy, never been aboard a ship.
Where was this at that you were stationed at?
Los Alamitos.
Okay.
It's a Long Beach area.
Yeah.
And they had a racetrack right near there. And then they had the Marines had an ammo dump at Seal Beach, I believe they called it.
Okay.
And one of my memories there for that is that part of my duties, you had to spend a little time with the crash crew. And I was out with a crash crew once, and they had the DC-6s came in there for flying munitions from the ammo dump over the Pacific. And so they came to Los Alamitos to load up their munitions. And one time they had a DC-6 came in there, and they were loading that up, and I was standing by the fire truck. And, you know, oil running out of the engine pods. There's, you know, 2-3 foot pool of oil
right.
under the engines with the oil running out. You notice on the wings there's rivulets of fuel running down the wing, rivulets of fuel.
Oh, my gosh.
And then these guys were, like, say, flying munitions across the Pacific.
And they didn't care?
This was just normal operation?
Just,
yeah, we just, you know, we had our foam truck, so if they didn't caught a fire, we could put it out.
Oh, my gosh.
I'll remember that. And then when they took off, that they had the engine quit on takeoff. And they just stopped,
this
turned
was
around.
On a DC-6?
Yeah, DC-6.
So you've got four of them, right?
Yeah. Well, they taxied back out the end of the runway and started the engine taxiing back, got the engine running again.
No.
Turned around.
No.
And away they went. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And this was in, actually about 1960, probably.
And this was down at Los Alamitos?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. And this was just normal operation?
Nobody cared?
No supervisor running out stop?
No.
Do you know if they made the flight successfully?
I have no idea. Of course, you would not know if they'd tell you.
Wouldn't know if they'd tell you or not. Oh, my gosh.
But that's one of our memories there. That, one of those things you'll never forget. Another thing I'll never forget, too, is the fog, the smog they had. This was in those days when they really had smog.
Okay.
And they had C-130s were fairly new then, I think.
Okay.
And the big turboprops. And so when they took off, those big turboprops, when they broke through the smog layer, those big turboprops would suck the fresh air down in the fog. And so it just looked like a reverse cloud.
Oh my gosh.
You see the smog with clear clouds in the smog. And so I'll never forget that. That's one of the memories, too, is those big turboprops just sucking that clean air down in the fog.
Yeah, those things throw a lot of wind behind them.
Yeah.
A lot of wind behind them. So let's kind of jump back a little bit back to Nebraska when. With family now, mom and dad, what were they doing at this time?
Well, my dad ran a trucking company.
Okay. Was this the trucking company you worked working for?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And mom, she was a housekeeper, you know, back in the good old days.
Back when moms were moms, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of like that. Love and respect.
And we had, our house was right on the edge of the town. So there's farm fields right behind our town, right behind our house. And so...
Brothers and sisters?
Yeah. I had four brothers and sisters. I have three brothers, one sister, five total, you know.
Wow. And you're all living in a 4,000 square foot home, right?
Well, not quite, but it's probably a 2,000 square foot home. And like I say, right on the edge of the country. And where, like I say, kids, I take my .22 and go shooting.
Go shooting all that.
And then, too, that I just... tell them when they had fireworks during 4th of July. And then when I was a teenager, they started banning fireworks, you know.
Mm.
And so we kids, we went down to the hardware store and bought gun blasting powder, stump powder. And so we had a lot of farmhouses that were abandoned then because a lot of small farmers were going out of business, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd go out in the countryside and get those brass doorknobs off these old farmhouses, fill them full of stump powder, put the fuse in it. We'd have a hand grenade.
You know? Oh, my gosh.
And we'd toss those around, and they couldn't find that. So we went down to the hardware store, and we bought pipes and caps, you know, and made pipe bombs, you know. And it worked good. And
nobody got hurt.
Nobody got hurt.
Then
we made mortars, too. I got a mortar with a, you know, 2-inch pipe, 3-inch pipe.
Yeah.
And then we'd put a pipe bomb down it, and it'd blast it out.
Right.
We could shoot that out, maybe a quarter of a mile.
Wow.
Down the pasture behind our house and scare the hell out of the cows, you know. But... quit that because one time that I don't know what happened, but the recoil, the pipe tilted it up, so it kind of shot it straight up in the air. And so I didn't know which way to run. I said, oh, shit, we shouldn't do that.
We shouldn't do this anymore. Yeah. So was there any interest of aviation in this early youth of yours?
Not really. Well, I had model airplanes. I made model airplanes, and I tried to make control line airplanes, but like say my brain hand coordination, I'd crash them before I learned how to fly them. You know, I just
you weren't alone, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, like I say, it took me about probably, if I had a 5 second flight, that's pretty good, you know.
And then smack, yeah. Balsa everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And so finally I gave up on that and I made a free flight and I had just a regular plans. And so.
So this wasn't a kit. This was just plans.
Yeah.
So you bought the balsa. And tissue and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Okay.
And, but then too, I modified the plans in that I use half size for material. So instead of a, 16 inch thick, I'd use a, 32nd inch thick. And so I just made it the same size, but the structure was lighter.
Oh, I see.
A light structure. And so it was real light. And then I put they had 049 was the standard little, right. But they had one smaller than that.
They had an 02 and they had an 010, right? So the Cox.
I don't remember the 010, but I remember probably the 02.
Yeah.
And then I put a three-bladed prop on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of ran like a tractor.
Explain. What do you mean ran like a tractor?
Well, it didn't have enough power to spool it up.
Oh, I see. So your RPM was quite low.
Yeah. It sounded like a tractor when it was running. and then... the airplane would just float like a fly, or like a leaf, because it was so light and it had enough that so it could fly, I could do it. And then when the engine quit or something went wrong, I just take my hand up and lift it out of the sky.
Oh my gosh.
So
it never really climbed real high and flew away. It just would.
Well, it could if you had a breeze. If you had a breeze, it would, just like a glider, if you don't fly a glider on a windy day,
And so you got several flights out of this.
Oh, yeah. That's the only plane I could fly and had a plane to take home,
So now were you doing this with friends or was this just?
Just myself.
Just yourself.
Yeah. I didn't have any friends that were in aviation.
What do you think piqued this interest in you?
I have no idea. Well, I like to build things.
Okay.
By nature, I'm a builder. Okay. And so that was that. Yeah, I made all kinds of stuff, tore stuff apart and put it back together just as a kid,
And yeah. You thought you'd do this with an airplane.
Yeah. And then, when I learned how to fly it back then, too, it was a lot easier. Of course, in Nebraska, they didn't have... didn't have any conflicts. There's just nothing but fields all around you.
Right. Nebraska's pretty flat. Yeah.
Not a lot of traffic. There's no air traffic.
So did you just end up walking out to the airport one day?
Well, no. I got lessons. And then, too, back then, I think I was 5 hours, I was soloed, And in a J3.
So how did you get those lessons? Was this something that parents gifted to you?
Yeah. Or? Well, they essentially gifted me to it.
Okay.
And then.
So you walk out to the airport and say you need some lessons. Yeah. How old were you at this point?
Like I said, I was about 19 years old. Then. Okay. I was not just a little kid then.
Okay.
But the airport was on the other side of town. And, in a small town, it's different. I was, mechanically inclined. And so when I wanted to make stuff, I have a problem. Well, I'd go to the blacksmith shop and they'd help me out,
Right.
And they had about three blacksmith shops in town. You go to an auto shop, they'd let you stand around and watch them work and see what they're doing. That building a house, you go there, stand around, you watch, and
nobody telling you to get lost.
No, nobody, you run you off there, and they're happy to explain what they're doing.
Yeah.
They'd tell you what they're doing and this and that.
Sort of that real Midwest kind of friendly kind of attitude, right?
Well, then too, it wasn't. They didn't have the. They had to get their work done, but they did. They weren't so pressed in time.
Right.
They'd take a little extra time.
Right.
that they, you know him as Preston. They didn't have to get this house built in 3 months, you know. You know, generally it took about a year to build a house then, you know. Nowadays, they pull the frame up in a week, they've got the roof on it, you know. And back then, it wasn't like that. Of course, back then, too, it was saw and a hammer. You know, they had no pre-cut pieces.
Right, everything was built on site. You had a cabinet maker.
Well, then, too, you measured everything else. You didn't have pre-cut studs.
Yeah.
You'd have to, you know, saw every stud off.
The trusses didn't show up on the back of a truck. Yeah, built the truss right then and there.
And so the whole attitude was different, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole attitude was different.
So that the town you grew up in, remind me again, was Beale?
Beatrice.
Beatrice, okay.
We call it Beatrice. It's a woman's name.
Okay.
It was a woman's name. Beatrice is how you pronounce a woman's name.
So how's that town doing now, today?
Oh, still there. Same size, maybe a little bit bigger, but it's not wasting away.
Is it an agricultural community?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that's pretty much what keeps it around?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Agricultural.
Any family back there still?
Nope. I'm the last of my family.
Okay.
Yeah. I had aunts and uncles and grandmothers and grandfathers and all around there, you know. Mm-hmm. But as time goes, people disappear.
They disappear, yeah. They migrate away. And
Yeah.
I know the exact same feeling.
And so we don't have any Davisons there at all, right? Well, we might. Not in my exact family line, but close, you know.
So now let's jump back forward to Navy. You're in the Navy. You're traveling. You're in California now.
Yeah.
What happens after California?
Well, I stayed there in California for the Navy. And then when I got out, one of my experiences was when in the Navy, I had a BSA motorcycle, the one I was racing in.
Okay.
And I drove that out to California. And I sold it in California. And I flew back to Nebraska when I was discharged on a C-14 or 47, C-47, the old DC-3. And I always remember that flight because you fly along and you rum. You look down and there's a river down there. And it seemed like you're flying another hour. You look down there and that river is just a little bit further back there. I thought I'd never get that. I flew there from there to from Riverside. I got on the Air Force flight from Riverside, California to, I forgot that they had an airfield in Oklahoma.
Okay.
And got to Oklahoma. And then I hitchhike from there to my hometown. And so that's how I got back to my hometown.
And what did you start doing when you got back
home? And then when I got back, well, then I went to university. I went, but I went to engineering. Like I say, I've always been a mechanic, you know. Okay. Like I say, when I was a kid, build engines, you know, that didn't have any training. You just did it, you know. That
right.
I forgot what my first engine was, but it was a Buick.
Okay.
Buick engine. And just tore it apart, got a junk, I bought an old junk car. I had a 55 Chevy.
Okay.
And of course, being a kid, I badly abused the engine on it. And so engine was starting to burn oil. I said, well, I got to put a new engine. I said, shoot, I'd kind of like to put this big Buick engine in it. And so I bought a junk Roadmaster with a V8, one of the early V8 Buicks.
Right, right.
And took the engine out and rebuilt the engine. And then it had a twin pitch Dynaflow transmission in it. So I put that in too. And so, and then I spliced it onto the Chevy drive line.
Oh my gosh.
The Buick had a torque tube in it, while the Chevy just had open drive line. So I converted it to an open drive line. And so I had that big engine with the Chevy rear end in it. Suck gas something fierce. But at any rate, so I had that when I went to school in engineering. And like I say, I was never that good of a student. And so I got by, but I just didn't feel like have my parents pay for it.
And what university was this at?
University of Nebraska.
Okay.
And so I got a, first I got a job in a machine shop. And, but then to keep the job, I had to join the, they had the right to work laws and this and that. But, but if you didn't join the union, they'd find a reason to fire you.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And I didn't want to join the union because my father had union problems. And so then I worked at the state hospital as a mental mental technician, mental aid, hospital aid. Well, anyway, I worked in the security wards in mental hospital. And with that, I could work at nights and then go to school days. And so I could, I could support myself and go to school at the same time.
Oh, great.
And so all I had to do at night was just keep the lid on the place. And in the security wards, they had three aides for each ward. And so you had the patients had were locked in their rooms to sleep. And then when they had to go to the bathroom, they rang a bell and, you know, three of you went and escorted them to the bathroom.
Right.
And then escort them back. And so that's what, you know, I could study.
Right, right.
And then, too, that got me through school.
And so you eventually graduate?
Yeah.
What year was this?
I graduated in 66.
Okay, with a degree in mechanical engineering.
Yes, uh-huh.
What do you do after college then?
Well, then I looked for work. And I'd read an article on in the magazine on the Olympic Peninsula. And I thought, man, that's cool. So I'm going to go out there and find work out there.
So you didn't have a job. You just decided you're going to pack up and head out to the Olympic Peninsula.
Yeah, yeah. And so I had, at that time, I had another motorcycle. I had a Ducati motorcycle. And got a little trailer. And I had a Saab car, a little two-stroke, three-cylinder Saab car. And came out and looking for work. And I finally got work with Volkswagen distributorship there in Portland, Hillsboro.
Oh, okay.
And but I had a girlfriend back in Nebraska. And so after about 6 months, couldn't get here. She wouldn't come back here without getting married. And then it was a little soon to start talking about that. And so I went back to Nebraska. And I was in aviation. So I decided, well, shoot, you know, what are you going to do around there? Engineering degree. And I've always been mechanic at heart. And so I went to A&P school there in Lincoln Aviation. They had a World War II mechanic school that was left over from World War II.
Okay.
And so I went to that school and got my A&P. And then I worked for a couple of years as an A&P mechanic for the company. And then I got married, you know, as an A&P mechanic.
Was this with the girlfriend?
Huh?
Was this the girlfriend?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, she's my wife now.
Okay.
We've been married over 50 years now.
Congratulations. That's impressive.
And so there that there's a Piper dealership. And a lot of farmers, you know, they never got a pilot's license. They just flew, you know.
Right.
And this one farmer, well, they had all kinds of stuff. They had one time a farmer came in there with the neck in his prop. And you could stop the engine and get fuel. And from 50 feet away, you could see the neck in the prop.
Oh, my gosh.
And he'd backed into the reversible as a twin engine, and he'd backed into a steel fence post and it took a chunk out of his prop. And he was flying it like that.
Engines, right?
Yeah. I had two experiences though. That
did you go point this out to him?
Yeah, yeah. He had a file. You could see where he had a rat tail file where he kind of smoothed out the edges on it. But still, the neck looked like about the size of a dime.
My gosh.
And but at any rate, had another incident there where the guy had an older airplane with a round engine in it. I can't remember what kind of plane it was.
Okay.
It was one of the older...
Like a Stearman type?
Yeah.
But was it a biplane, single wing?
I can't remember. All I remember is that it was a real dirty okay. airplane. But after he fueled it up, he took the fuel hose and just washed the engine off with the avgas. And so he was there. You can see the vapors hit the hot pipes. They're just the steam come up. When
oh,
hit,
my God.
And the fuel running down the ground, you know, this and that. And you go, what the hell are you doing there? Oh, I got to wash it off. You know, I got this oil, you know. If I don't wash it off all the time, it's impossible to clean, he said.
Oh my God!
And so that's the a lot of the spirit they had back there, you know,
and the avgas just flowing on the ground.
Yeah, no problem. He just pushed it back before he started it. Oh my God. Yeah, and then too. Well, like I say, while I got out here, was that one of the farmers that ran out of gas and landed his plane in a snowdrift. This is in the winter in Nebraska. Okay. And so I had to go out to take the airplane apart to bring it in. And I was up my ass in snow, and my hands freezing to the tools. And I said, God, there's be a better way to make a living than this. You know? And so I put an application into Boeing. And then at the same time, we had another good friend of ours that she wanted to come out to the Midwest if you want to make a grand tour to L.A. and up to Seattle and then back to Nebraska. And so she says, well, if you'll drive me, I'll buy all your gas and pay your motel bills and everything. If you'll just take me and her daughter. And so I was
just to be a chauffeur.
Yeah, just to be your chauffeur. And so we came out here, made the grand tour with my little Saab, with four of us in the Saab, and stopped at Boeing. I'd put in an application before I left, you know, for
right.
Boeing. And then when we were at the Boeing here, plant there, Renton, they had administration building in Renton. And I went there and I filled out another application, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then I went back to Nebraska. And then when I got back to Nebraska, I had the letter from Boeing said they accepted me and gave me the dates and that. They're going to move me out and all my household goods and everything.
Oh, my gosh.
And so.
What was the position as?
As a mechanic.
Okay.
And so, great, I accepted it. And then about 3 or 4 weeks later, I got another letter from Boeing. It says they were sorry, but they weren't hiring anymore.
Oh, my
that,
gosh.
So I threw that letter away.
Didn't even happen. Didn't happen.
I just threw it away and came out here. Well, they had, the Boeing moving van showed up and they took all my household goods and everything and loaded them up and took them to Washington here. And then I worked on the first 1547s as a mechanic. And mainly what I did was they called a corporate change mechanic, where they had changes to things, that design changes. And one of the problems was that it was so chaotic then that sometimes change B came after change C, you know. And
oh my
so
gosh.
You didn't know that. So you put this change C out, you put in change B, you know. And that's one of my memories there. And
then, was this at Everett then where you were working?
Yeah,
so were they still building the building at that point?
Yeah, so
they were building the aircraft.
Well, they pretty much finished the building by the time I got there.
Okay.
I got there in 69.
Okay.
October of 69.
So the program was well under the way for
well,
this 47.
Yeah, I worked on the first 15.
Okay.
And I got laid off in May of 70. So I worked there about 6 months and got laid off.
Oh my gosh.
And
why would they do that?
Well, they ran out of money.
Oh.
See, they were one reason why I had a job is because the Boeing, they could get loans on the airplane when they left the factory. But if they're in the factory, they weren't really an airplane yet.
Mm.
But once they rolled out the factory door, they were considered an airplane and they'd get a loan on the airframe. And so they were pushing them out green, you know, with nothing in them. It's just a bare fuselage, you know. And so then they completed them on the flight line. I mean, that's why we had so many mechanics out there in the flight line doing all the completion work, which should have been done in the factory.
And this was October. This was winter time.
Yeah. And then, too, you know, it was, like, say, May when I got laid off.
Okay.
But, you know, they just ran it. They essentially ran out of money. They just damn near went broke.
So now a question in your from your perspective. Rumor was that this was originally a cargo aircraft that they were going to make into a passenger. Is that a true statement, or is it?
Well, it was originally designed as a cargo airplane, but when they didn't get the military contract to build the cargo air. Now, whether they had that in the back of their mind to start with, they may have had that as well. Use the government money to design the airplane. And then after we get it going, we'll convert it and we'll sell them as commercial. I don't know what they had in the back. I have no way of knowing.
So the 15 that you were working on, were they cargo or
passenger? They're all passenger.
All passenger.
See, because by the time we worked on them, you know, the contract fell through before they really built any.
I got
you. You know, they didn't actually build any before the contract fell through. You know, and so, like I say, we built the first 15, and most of that was a lot of hand work done, you know. It was the first really big airplane, and so they had a lot of lessons to learn. Right. And because of the lessons I just mentioned, they had keeping the changes. They got the changes mixed up, and they had to have a big crisis where they had to put a big control center down there just to manage the paperwork, to make sure the paperwork didn't get mixed up.
What were some of the things that they were changing on the fly? Give me an example.
Mostly just minor hardware things. Things just didn't fit.
Okay.
You know, these were back in, everything was done on paper. And this was, they did have mechanical calculators then.
Right.
But most of it was slide rule airplane. And so you had, you know, three significant digits. And so you get a big airplane like this, and everything flexes.
Right.
And so you get it in the factory, and the jigs in the factory, and everything's held fairly decent. But then when you take it out of the jig, you know, there's preloads. When you everything put things together, you get some preloads built in it.
Yeah, because we're not talking 20 inches here. We're talking...
Yeah, 20 feet.
Yeah.
And
it's
so,
just a thermal expansion itself.
Yeah, well, like they just built in preloads. So you take it out of the tool and bing.
Yeah.
And then you take it, sit it on the floor, and then it droops. You know, everything's flexed like a piece of rubber. Yeah. And that's one of the things which when I counseled later on, when I was a liaison engineer and had to counsel the new people, I always counsel them. They say, you have to think of this airplane as made out of rubber, you know. Because you know,
it moves, flexes.
Yeah, it moves and flexes. And
that's probably even truer today with all the composite stuff that they're doing.
Well, composite a lot more rigid.
Really?
Yeah, the composites are much more rigid. That's one of the problems of composites is they're so rigid, they don't fail until they break. You know, the aluminum airplanes, when they fail, they'll stretch and bend. And when they bend, you still can fly them, you know.
Right.
But if they break, you can't fly
them. No, can't fly them anymore.
Yeah. And so that's one of the big dangers or one of the things to learn about composite airplanes is they've got to be really strong. You can't, you know, they won't, you know, on an airplane, it's designed to 1.5 times the critical load.
Right.
And then if you go over that, it can bend, but it's a flyable airplane.
Right.
And so you can take it flat home and fix it, you know. And so that's the design of the airplane. That's how the philosophy on it. And the composite, of course, you can't do that.
No.
And but anyway, back to my original Boeing experience that I got laid off and couldn't find work. I rented a little trailer and I pulled the trailer from here to San Diego and
so
back.
So you're married at this time?
Yeah.
Any kids?
I had a one-year-old. One-year-old daughter. So I had a little rental trailer and pulled that behind the car with all my camping gear. And so we camped along the way, and I interviewed at air stations along the way, right. Airports along the way. Of course, there had people been laid off before me, and so it's hard to find
out. They were filling those jobs, yeah.
Yeah, there weren't any vacancies. I didn't find any vacancies. And so I got to San Diego and then started coming back. I had a sister who lived in L.A. I got a reply from a airport in Riverside that wanted to interview me.
Okay.
And so it's a real smoggy day. I mentioned smoggy when I was in the right. Navy. It was just as bad at this time too. And so all the way to get that interview, I just, oh, I sure hope they don't have a job. I hope they don't have a job. You know, because you had to work. You
right.
Know? Yeah, I needed
right.
a job, but right. I sure didn't want to work there. And and so I didn't get the job, and I was just as happy. And then when I got back to my sister's place, I got a place I'd interviewed in Sacramento. Yeah.
Yeah.
Got a reply from there. They had a job over. They wanted me to come back to have a final interview for there. So we pulled our stuff in the wagon, went back there. And when I got there, they said, well, we had a second thought. So we decided we weren't going to hire anybody.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I just headed on back to Seattle, and because I liked Seattle area. And no job. And so I said, well, shoot, no aviation. And so I said, well.
What are you doing for funds during this time? You just living off the
same? Well, Boeing was very generous to me.
Okay.
And that they gave me all the money they got to take me here, take me from Nebraska to Seattle. They gave me the same amount of money to go back.
Oh.
And so I had that. And then you had unemployment insurance.
Okay.
You know, and so with that right there, it kept me going.
So you're not living on steak and eggs, but you're still managing to get by.
And then I had to send my money to my sister, and then I'd telephone her, and she'd, you know, wire the money to me along the way.
Okay.
And then went back to Seattle here, couldn't find work, and then I said, well, shoot, I'm just going to have to find some other kind of stuff. I said, well, I'm a mechanic, and so how about automotive? And so I started interviewing some automotive places.
Right.
And I had worked for Volkswagen earlier, you know.
Okay.
And then I had a sports car place down on Lake Washington with exotic cars.
Okay.
And so I interviewed there, and they said, well, no, that says we don't have anything, but I know of the place where you probably get a job. And Pete Lovely, who ran a Volkswagen dealership in Fife, he was a race car driver too.
Okay.
He married into money, which is good.
Yeah. Kudos to him.
And so they say, well, they knew that he was looking for, they needed fuel injection. The newer Volkswagen had come out, were coming out with fuel injection, the Type 3.
Okay.
It's coming out with fuel injection. They needed somebody that said, I told him, shoot, you know, I worked on pressure carburetors, you know, that's
pretty similar.
One step, you know.
Right.
What I don't know, I can learn, you know.
Right.
And so I went down there and got interviewed and got a job as a Volkswagen mechanic. And so when you took my beginning wage and everything else, that what I sacrificed in my unemployment and all that with the insurance, that I made for a month's worth of work, you know, uh-huh. I made another extra, I think it was about $65 extra, you know.
That okay.
For, you know, 160 hours worth of work, I made $65. <You know? laughs> But then the good thing about that was, well, you know, that's just your starting.
Right.
You know? And so with my background, like say that, I worked there for about 3 years.
And you were probably pretty good after that.
Yeah, well, actually, within a year and a half, I was a shop foreman.
Oh. There you go.
And so, you know, right. At any rate, so I started looking for other work. And then so I heard they had a 92nd Aviation up there. They were looking for civil service mechanics. And so I went and interviewed there and got a job, or got an offer for this civil service mechanic working on the 92nd Aviation C-47 helicopters, your twin rotor
C-47. Right, right, right.
So I got a job working on those. And then it just so happened that just Christmas time, and they had a Christmas party at the Volkswagen place. And all that previous 6 months, I've been telling the mechanics, I was a shop foreman then, and so I tell the mechanics they just couldn't afford to give out wages because the company just didn't have any money, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an absentee boss, owner, Pete Lovely. And then for the Christmas party, he came in there and he congratulated everybody. We had best year in the history of the company.
Oh, my gosh.
It had a fantastic year. And so I was really pissed.
I can understand.
And so then I had that job offer. So I just, the next day, I turned in my time and said, hey, I'm out of here, you know.
Right.
And so just left there and went to work up here at Everett in the 92nd Aviation as a helicopter mechanic. And there's a little story there, too.
I love stories.
That when I went to interview, you know, earlier in the fall, I went to, I forgot exactly the dates here, but I drove up the 128th where you turn off the I-5 to go to Payne Field. I turned off there, come off over the ramp. I noticed a big black column of smoke right over the area there. And so when I got there, the guy I was going to interview with had just crashed a helicopter.
Oh, my gosh.
That he and his other shop, he was a top shop foreman I was going to interview with. And he and his sidekick, they were running a helicopter up, but they shouldn't have been done it. It was gusty. And a gust of wind tipped the helicopter up, and the front blade hit the concrete.
Oh, no.
And the twin rotor.
Right. Once you hit one.
Yeah. Well, like I say, it sheared the drive line and it interfered, and the whole thing just self-destructed. That whole helicopter, the biggest part was the flight deck on that. The biggest part left. And there were just pieces scattered all over.
Oh, my gosh.
And then it was full of fuel, so it had 1,000 gallons worth of fuel.
So it's going up.
Yeah, that all went up. And he got out.
But they got out?
They got out. They just had, like, sunburns from the flames and that, just like they had a bad sunburn. But anyway, that
interview.
Did
he still interview you?
No, the interview was off. So I came back a week later and had an interview. But,
okay.
But that's a story with that job there.
What year was this?
That was about 75, I think, 74, okay. 75. And
that was a pretty active place back then.
Yeah,
I remember that being very active.
Yeah, it was active.
Yeah.
And, you know, they flew a fire watchtower. You know, their fire watchtowers were pretty big. They were at least probably 30 by 30, I think.
Okay.
And they flew one off the mountain in Olympics. In the Olympic Mountains.
Oh, my God.
Because that was declared a wilderness area. And so to make a wilderness area, they were taking all the man-made stuff out of there. And we had a lot of pilots from Vietnam.
Yeah.
You know, and the helicopter get there on the mountaintop didn't have enough lift to lift it up, you know. And so they undid all the supports. And so he got up and he went, and the momentum of the helicopter, it pulled it off the supports.
Oh, my gosh.
And going down the mountainside, he just kept it up. He gained speed where he could fly it.
And he got enough forward momentum to get enough lift off the rotors.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And then he flew it. He and his co-pilot flew it and brought it here to set it down over at Payne Field. They put it, and they had the Quonset hangars
right
out at the south end. And they set it down there. By the time they burned off enough fuel to where he could sit it down.
A little bit thicker air, burned off fuel.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was one of the things. But, you know, those guys had balls.
Oh,
you know?
I bet they had to change their underwear after that one.
Well,
huh?
Well, they were, these guys had stories of Vietnam. You know, they were adrenaline junkies, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so that reminds me of a story there, you know. But anyway, so I worked there for 4 or 5 years.
So at this time, were you starting to get involved with aviation locally at this point, or were
well,
you just...
didn't have any money. Shoot, that's a bad thing about private aviation is you got to have deep pockets.
Right.
And I didn't have any deep pockets. I had, you know, I had at that time I had 3 kids, and you know, job mechanic. It didn't pay bad, but you ain't gonna get rich, you know.
And your wife's staying home, being a mother, and you've got a house, I imagine, at this point.
Yeah.
Okay. So
and so
priorities. I know those priorities.
Yeah. And so I didn't have any money for that.
Yeah.
But
But it's still in the back of your head that this is something you want to do.
Oh, yeah.
You've got a pilot's license.
Yeah.
But just not flying.
Yeah. And so, like say that, work for 982nd Aviation, where I did all kinds of stuff. That the airframe, you know, you basically airframe mechanic, and then later on their engine mechanic quit, and then I worked on the engines too, the turbines.
So oh,
I had a power plant in that, and. For the government, there's limited what you could do. I'm just trying to think of, I think the hot section, I don't think you do much at all, the hot section. Yeah, I think you could replace a couple blades of the turbine. There's a number of blades you could replace, but there's limited, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's mainly just inspections and teardown, you know, teardown inspections for the engines.
And so then you would take that and chip it off to some contractor to work on that?
Well, if you had something serious you weren't authorized to do, then you had to.
Did you do it in-house there, or did you have to ship it off someplace else?
Oh, we did everything in-house except what you're allowed to do.
Right.
And then if you weren't allowed to do, well, then the government, you put it in a can and they give you another can. You know? and so that was it, you know.
Put it in a can and they give you another can.
Yeah.
That should be on a t-shirt.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, work for civil service. The problem is you had to be a member of the reserve, to have the job, the Navy Army Reserve, and then you worked on helicopters 5 days a week, and so I didn't want to work on helicopters 5 days for my reserve time, and so I volunteered to be the cook.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I was the cook for the...
What haven't you done in your life?
And so I did that, and I really enjoyed that, too, because the Army bought pretty good food.
Yeah.
And the cooks sometimes...
I just can't imagine the youth today saying, well, I'll just go cook, you know? And I think they lose out on a lot of that experience, being able to... Just say, well, I'm going to go do this to make it happen.
Yeah, and one of my good memories of that is we had one of the summer camps in Europe. Went to Germany they had some combined operation there.
Right,
and I was a cook there, and so I had 24 on, 24 off. And so everybody else was stuck there, you know, 8 hours, you know, 24/7. But I had every other day off, and we were supposed to stay on the base. But I and my fellow cook, we had there's a hole in the fence, and we went through the fence, and there's a gymnasium not too far away, just a couple blocks outside the fence, to go to the gymnasium, change our clothes. And so we went out in the countryside every other day, you know, get on the train or go here or go there, you know.
So where would you go?
Oh, there all, I was interested in your old buildings, your old castles, cathedrals, and that kind of stuff. I just love that old stuff, you know. And so that's what we'd do. I'd go there, and I forgot the only one I can think of. There's Heidelberg, wasn't too far. We went to Heidelberg. The Worms.
Okay.
Germany, I think it's Worms.
Worms.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
and a cathedral there. And back in that day, too, now this was back in 77, 76, I forgot, 78, I forgot exactly the date. But things were a lot looser back then, too. And
so who was your partner in crime in doing this?
I can't remember. I can't remember.
I was hoping we could call out a name here.
Yeah. The name slipped me now. But then, too, the old cathedrals and that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you just walk in the door and walk around.
And they didn't care.
Yeah, there was no guides, no nothing. So you just wander through the place. You go down the basement. Where all had
people
all these
respected
tombs.
Property yeah. back then, so they didn't.
Yeah.
They were. They knew everything was safe.
Yeah. So I had my camera. You know,
and you just take pictures.
Go all over. And I always thought.
How long did you end up doing this then? Huh? How long were you over there?
We were only over there 2 weeks, but and so they were shipped back there, and that was it. On the flight back, I remember the flight back, we came back on a Lockheed Electra. I forgot what the Army called them or the Air Force called them. But it was a commercial airplane. It was a contract carrier. So I think the Electra was, the military had one of the cargo planes was the same airframe, I think, as the Electra.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Well, anyway, these airplanes originally, they had the engine fell off them. They had a weakness in the nacelle.
Right, I remember this.
And they lose the wing on occasion. Well, by the time we were flying, they got that sorted out.
Yeah.
But that sucker flew. I forgot just how fast it flew, but I think that thing cruised somewhere around 400 miles an hour. That thing really got out and cooked.
So you could move.
Yeah, it really cooked. And so the flight back here wasn't that much different than the jet, really.
Wow.
You know, because that, I remember that. So we landed right here at Payne Field.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Landed right here at Payne Field.
And then just disembarked and you were back home.
Yeah. Well, actually, it stopped in somewhere in New York or somewhere around there.
For refueling purposes?
Probably, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Now
you're back here and
in the reserve, in the civil service.
At some time, Boeing calls you back up and says,
well, okay, there's another story there.
Okay. I love stories.
That working at civil service, you know.
Right.
It was, they had to have enough manpower, so if they were activated, they'd have enough manpower to do the job.
Right.
You know, if you're activated.
That makes sense.
And well, in peacetime, with as little as flying as they do, you had three times more people than you really needed. And so, you know, you leave the job, you had to get a tool. Normally, if you're working to make your money, make a living, you do a job, you get all the tools, you take it, and you do your job and use the tools you need to do. And like I said, in the helicopters, there's quite a few special tools you need.
Right.
To change parts and what have you. And so you'd get one tool, do your job, or a little part of your job, then you go back, you get the other tool, and then come back.
Did you have to, like, check this in and then check it out?
Kind of. You know? I don't think it was that. It wasn't that formal.
Okay.
But anyway, you had to, you know, go to the tool room, get it, and then come back. And so you did that, so a job that'd take you 2 or 3 hours, it'd take you a day and a half.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, because, well, you had the time. You know, there's no
great rush.
And then, too, there's had so many people, when you come back, there'd be someone else stepping in doing your job, you know. And so I was at home. I was getting bad habits. You know, you get those lazy habits. And I noticed at home it'd take me, you know, twice as long to do a job at home as it should, you know, because I just, you know, getting those lazy habits. So I decided, hey, I'm going to have to quit this job or I'm going to be ruined. If I keep up with this, you know, it's going to ruin me.
You're looking at the future and going, this isn't the kind of person I want to be.
Yeah.
A little bit more achievement.
So I went back to Boeing. And they hired me back. I went interviewed, and they hired me back as a journeyman.
Okay.
And so that's one of the good things about Boeing is they keep your records.
Right.
And so when I went back, I had no problem getting on because I had a good recommendations of my previous supervisors. And so I got hired back really easy, and I was really happy about that. And I was hired back as a mock-up mechanic, and I worked on the 6-7.
Okay.
The original 6-7. And I made the wood mock-up for, all we did there was just the pressure bulkhead was in wood. And then the rest of the empennage was just stock sheet metal, you know, extrusion angles and what have you, and made it out of sheet metal.
And this is all at the Everett plant?
Yeah.
And Everett, and what year about?
69.
Okay.
No. 79.
79, yeah.
79 and maybe into 80. And anyway, when we finished up the 6-7 mock-up, you know, and then...
So were there 6-7s flying yet? This was just the development?
No, they didn't even have built the first one yet.
Okay.
You know, just the mock-up, the Class 2 mock-up.
Okay.
And like bragged a little bit, we did such a good job on the Class 2 mock-up that they didn't build a Class 3.
Oh, my gosh.
And so they just built a protection plan.
So each class of a mock-up was a little bit more refined?
The Class 3 is... used with production parts.
I gotcha.
You know.
And this was before CAD, so they weren't doing all this
work. Well, CAD was just coming in. CAD was just coming in.
But they weren't doing complete virtual.
No.
They still had the mock-up, and this is how they test fit parts.
This is the last mock-up.
So were you actually like running plumbing and wiring through these mock-ups?
Yeah.
Okay.
And fiberglass stuff that... you made that from scratch, you know, that one of the jobs I had was making some of the fiberglass ducting. And so you got the engineering coordinates and you mocked up, made your own jig, and then you fabricated the tubes.
So what would happen if you found a problem? What were the sequences that if a part didn't fit?
Well, you had to verify there was a problem.
Okay.
You know, and then you go back to engineering and then they'd redo their engineering.
So would you go back to the original engineering group, or was it like...
the original engineering group. Because this was their still original drawings. You know, because these drawings hadn't really been finalized yet. You know?
So they hadn't been released to a production level. They were still at an engineering level type of...
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, I kind of say that may not have been strictly true in all cases, you know, but generally it was true.
And was this... a specific team that did a specific area of the aircraft, or did the team just keep moving on to different areas of the aircraft?
No, you had specific teams.
Okay.
And then, too, that specific area. This has been getting on 40 years ago, you know.
But just yesterday.
Yeah. But at any rate, so when the mock-up was finished, what am I going to do? And so I transferred to engineering.
Okay.
Because I did have the engineering degree from Nebraska.
Correct. Yeah.
But because it had been a number of years, mm-hmm. Boeing didn't want to recognize the degree right away.
Gotcha.
And so I transferred engineering as a tech. And then after a year and a half, then they recognized, gave me a professional rating.
Gotcha.
And so the last 20 years of my Boeing, I was a professional engineer.
Gotcha. And that's 23 years you spent at Boeing then?
Yeah.
Total, or was just that stretch?
Total. That's total.
Okay. Yeah. And that was all at the Everett plant?
Yeah, all at the Everett plant.
What were some of the programs you worked on there?
Well, 6-7, 4-7. 4-7, a lot of changes on that. About every year or so, I worked... on a project in what we call project, on the regular engineering staff. You know, I transferred and worked in one time as did the overwing longeron for extended range airplane. And so you had to re-engineer it for the extended range to carry more weight. And so you had to grow up, I forgot what the figures they gave us. We had to grow at 10 or 15%, you know, to carry the extra stretches.
Right.
And so sometimes you had to make a larger, heavier structural piece, mm-hmm. which also gave you problems with space, you know, everything's got to fit. Sometimes it was just a fastener problem. The piece was strong enough already, but you just had to get the fastener where it transmit the loads, you know. But at any rate, at the Boeing, I was a lead engineer when I was retired.
Okay.
And I was getting kind of bored. They're changing the philosophy. It used to be you did a lot of repairs. Mm-hmm. And it got to be the customers didn't want a repair. They wanted a new part. And sometimes it's kind of foolish because sometimes you do more damage replacing parts than you would repairing the structure originally.
Splicing in something rather than taking it all out.
Yeah. But at any rate, a lot of the engineering was gone. And so the fun was gone. There's not much engineering to do. You know, repairing, make sure your repair part was as good as the original structure and that. And so it was more of a clerk type job, really. And so I said, shoot, you know, it's not good. And so I started thinking about retirement. And so I was a little early, but I started thinking about it. And then they had a lot of training programs, but a lot of the training programs were, you know, getting obsolete.
Okay.
And so I took a lot of the repair training manuals and I started to rework them, you know, and rewrite them, so to speak, to bring them up to date. And so the last 2 years before I retired that I worked on the training manuals, and the last year and a half I ran a training course and training the existing engineers on doing repair work.
Oh, okay.
And so I did that for a year and a half.
You had an excellent background in order to be able to do that. Yeah. You had both the A&P along with the engineering.
Yeah. And so I retired at 61, I think. Retired. And then when I retired, I wanted to build an airplane, you know.
Right.
And so...
So were you flying at all at this point?
No. I didn't really start flying until I really was running out of time.
Okay.
But
so you're thinking of retiring? So yeah. You say,
well, I needed a shop. I was going to build an airplane, do my stuff, because I'm a builder. You know, I'm not a. And so I got a permit to build a shop. And that's getting a permit from the county. Man, that was a you had to get them to say yes, or they voluntarily say no.
Right.
And you had to, force them to say yes. And generally that took a separate certified engineer, and I had to hire biologists and everything else to get to build my shop because they could declare my land wetland. See. Actually, it took about a year. It took me about a year after I retired to finish the shop.
So now you're thinking about what airplane to put in it.
Well, I was always fascinated with the Burt Rutan airplanes.
Of course.
And I always liked that, you know. And
They're sexy.
So that's what I was going to build. And so I bought plans for it and started building it. And I had my son there to help me a little bit.
Had you joined EA Chapter 84 at this time yet?
I think I had.
Okay.
Yeah. And, but took my time. It took me 5 years to build it. And when I got it built, I was really proud of it. I took a lot of pains on it.
Right.
And rewatched, I'd done fiberglass design work there at Boeing, and I worked on their fiberglass repair manuals and that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was familiar with the requirements of it.
Right.
And I was aware of how important processes were in fiberglass.
Right.
You know, that and I'd say wood. If you're working on wood, your processes is really important. With metals, you can see a bad hole, or you can see when you screw it up, you can see it easy. But with wood or fiberglass, the stuff gets buried. And so if you don't have the right processes, you can't tell that by looking at it.
Wow. Okay.
And so I was really paid close attention to the processes when I built my airplane, And so when I was done, I was really proud of it. And then finally it took me 5 years. Finally got it through the inspection process. And then Scott somebody. He's the flight advisor. He had a long ease.
Okay.
And then he gave me some familiarization flights. And
was he associated with the chapter here?
Not this chapter. Okay. But I think he was over, I forgot where he was, maybe one of the sister chapters, not too far away. But
Bellingham or Skagit or something like that.
Well, I think it's...
Maybe Seattle? 26?
Maybe Seattle. I don't know. Well, anyway, he's real close local.
Okay.
And he gave me a bunch of flights and got familiar with it. And at the same time here, you know, when they became appropriate, I came here to Harvey and got my biannual. And rented the airplane, got familiar flying the Cessna's 150, 172. And the process was much more rigorous than when I learned how to fly. You know, it took me, I think, what it was, 15 hours or so to get my biannual.
Okay.
And it's probably, I thought I was going to try 2 or 3 hours and I'll have it, you know.
So they were pretty thorough with
you. Yeah.
Well, you hadn't flown in how many years?
Well, I hadn't flown in 40 years.
Yeah.
Or 50 so years, then, yeah.
They're not, it's not Nebraska. They're not just going to sign you off and say, go fly.
Go burn holes.
Right.
Yeah. And so anyway, so I had an airplane at Arlington. First part, you do your taxi test.
Right.
And then you work up your the last part of your taxi test is you get it where you hold the nose off the ground where you're steady, you know. And first time I tried it, I get pilot induced oscillation, you know. I started bouncing a little bit, you know, because I was overreacting.
And that nose wheel on that airplane isn't exactly the most robust thing either.
Yeah, well, it does the job. But then the second taxi test, I had a little bit of oscillation. And then at the end of the second taxi test, I had it where I hold it.
Okay.
You know, I had one or two bounces, then I got it where I hold it all the way down the runway. I got it. So it was a really nice day. So I turned around and I'm going to fly this sucker. And so I turned around and took off. And that's when things went bad.
Yeah.
The thing is that I was so delighted the airplane flew so good that it flew straight and level. It did exactly what I wanted. You know, it had... I didn't have to
trim out
anything or nothing.
No heavy aileron.
No, nothing. You could fly it with two fingers.
Oh my gosh!
And I was just so delighted. I just euphoric. I threw caution to the wind. I said, "Screw it! I'm going to fly this sucker." And so you're supposed to stay over the airport for 10 hours or so. Shit, I took off and flew over the countryside. I was just happy as a lark, you know. And came back and landed. I screwed up a little bit on the landing coming in. So I landed about 5 foot too short or so, you know. And the airplane, too, is another one of the characteristics of the airplane, is you fly it down. You don't stall off.
Right, because it's a canard.
Yeah, you fly it to the ground.
Right.
And I was trying to kind of mush it in, you know, and I shouldn't have done that.
No.
Nope. And should have just flown it in. And but anyway, good, you know. But I was having some problems, too, on running rough on idle.
Right, right. I remember this.
And I figured it out, well, finally figured it out too late, but first, I thought it was a carburetor, you know. And then I put this Ellison fuel injection on.
And you were running an 0200, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I figured out, well, shit, you know, it's the air box into the carburetor. You know, the canard, I had no room for the original intake, you know.
Okay.
Because it was a pusher number one.
Right.
Of course, you could just turn it around, you know. But I didn't have the space, and so I used the original airbox, and then I made my own ducting with the gooseneck going into the carburetor.
Gotcha.
And I thought, well, shoot, that gooseneck is probably giving me the problem because you get vortexes. And so what I did, I made another deal. I used a Corvair air cleaner, and I made a fitting for that.
Okay.
And I put the air cleaner right up to the carburetor. So the air goes through the air cleaner, that round air cleaner. When it went through that air cleaner,
straightened it out.
Straightened out the air.
Yeah.
And that ran good then. But then I had the Ellison carburetor on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually requires a different fuel system. Because your carburetor, if you have air in the system, it just dumps in the float bowl and it exits the float
right.
bowl.
And the Ellison no is more...
It's just like carburetor. If you got to get the air out of the system.
Yeah,
so,
it's more of a throttle body than a carburetor, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, but you need a recirculating fuel system.
Gotcha.
You know, like you know, your fuel injected cars,
right?
You know, there's a recirculating, and so you get bubbles or whatever in it,
mm-hmm.
it just dumps it back in the fuel tank. Well, I don't know if that was my problem or not. But anyway, my second flight, again, I threw caution to the wind. You know, the damn thing flew so good. You know, I was just, you know, just so happy.
Happy as a clam.
Yeah, just so happy of just flying. You know, what could go wrong, you know? And so I was over. I shouldn't be telling all this because you're violating all those federal rules. But,
well, you learned a lesson, so you're explaining to people what not to do, right?
Yeah. Well, anyway, I was over Mount Vernon,
uh-huh.
which was in my flight pattern. I had my...
Yeah, you've got your restricted area.
Restricted area was in the foothills.
Test area, yeah.
Yeah, but at any rate, that my tachometer went screwy, you know. First, it started going back and forth, and then it just started going around in circles. That electric tachometer.
Oh, my gosh.
And, oh, shit. Yeah, so, well, no problem. You don't need a tach anyway. I mean, shoot. I can hear it's running, you know. It's
mm-hmm.
Who needs a tach, you know? You know, you don't pay that much attention to the tach, you know. And I should turn around. I should go back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it may be telling me something. And so I flew back to Arlington, went into the pattern, and I was a little bit low on the pattern,
mm-hmm.
Coming into the base leg, and a little bit low. I thought, well, shoot, I better give it some gas to get a little altitude, you know. Yeah, just I'm a little low. And so I went and gave it gas, and nothing happened.
Oh, my gosh.
And the engine to quit.
So just as you're giving it gas, it just went... Dead.
As far as I know. And so, shoot, what am I going to do? They got a sand pit there at the end of the runway.
Right.
And I said, can't hit that sand pit. That'll be the end of me. You know, didn't want to hit that. And then they had a nice green field to the north and to the a little bit west.
Right.
Ah, oh, that looks perfect, you know. And so I... And then, too, at the same time, they had in my mind that about the month before or so, or even less, I forgot what the timing was, but we had two accidents there. One with both very experienced pilots.
Mm-hmm.
One with the aerobatic pilot, a lady with lots of experience, had crashed over by Camino Island somewhere around in there and killed her.
Okay.
And we had a Boeing test pilot in his RV or something south of Renton. He crashed into the building, I think killed him too.
And so this is going through your mind.
Yeah. I said, hey, you know, don't forget to fly the airplane. You know, both these cases that they didn't have the airspeed and they stalled out and spun in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, hey, keep your airspeed, fly the airplane, keep your airspeed. And so that's what I was paying attention to. So when it's coming in for the landing there, I was happy as a clam because I felt, boy, I was doing everything right. And it's just as happy as a clam. And when I landed down, it's like somebody turned off my lights. I don't remember crashing, don't remember nothing, you know.
Just boom.
It's just like somebody flipped my switch off.
So you must have hit your head pretty hard then.
And yeah, well, I say that what had happened is that the Varies has strikes on the end of the wings that tip down. And they have rudders that go up, but they had those dry. The grass, I thought, was a nice pasture. Well, it was a pasture, but the grass is about 3 feet high. And so what had happened is those wings caught that grass. And when it did that, it didn't take much. It flipped it right over. And so the people who washed it said it cartwheeled, you know, 3 or 4 times. But it beat me up pretty good. And so I remember waking up in the ambulance about 5 seconds or so. And I remember waking up in the CT scanner, that big round thing.
Right.
I remember seeing that for about 5 seconds. And next thing I remember is my wife sitting by my bedside, you know.
Was that the same day?
I don't know if it was the same day when I saw her or not. I don't know. I have to ask her. I don't know.
Don't remember.
But anyway, I was only in the hospital
for a day. You were glad you were alive still.
But I was discharged about a day and a half, I think. You know, and
I remember that day, and that was pretty tragic for all of us.
And, well, I say that I had my shoulder bone stuck up about 3 inches.
Okay.
And the doctor said they ain't going to do nothing about it. It'll gradually grow back, which it did, you know. But other than that, I came out scot-free.
Lucky man.
And so that's...
Flying all the way to the crash, right?
Yeah. And what gets me is I don't remember absolutely nothing about it.
So what would you do different today?
Well, follow the rules.
Okay.
You know, I had all the rules. I had all the recommendations, how to flight test your airplane. EAA's got all that stuff published. And... like say I guess just like raising my motorcycle down Main Street that I'm a risk taker, I guess, you know.
So did you ever figure out exactly what the issue was?
No, I didn't. It could be fuel error in the fuel line.
Okay.
It could be essentially a thing that when I wanted power, I pushed the power too quickly. The idle was maybe a little bit too slow, and you push the throttle too quickly, and then they get that lean charge goes through. If you're more gradual on the throttle, it may have been okay. I have no idea. The FAA said there's nothing wrong with the engine and nothing wrong with the system, you know.
Okay.
It just quit. And so I may have simply had my idle set too low, you know.
Wow.
And of course, if you set your idle higher, then it's not quite so sensitive on your throttle.
High idles also make for a little bit more difficult landing, too.
Yeah, but you got to fly at the ground anyway, you know. And so for the very E, that may have been what I should have done, you know.
In engineering, you never get something for nothing. There's always payoffs.
And so every day I think of that, every day, because I was so happy with the plane, so proud of the plane.
It was gorgeous.
And so proud of the plane and that. And then for stupidity, you know, just stupidity, you screwed it up, you know.
Well, as you said earlier, we're all human.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And humans make mistakes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like I say, this was, you know.
Forewarned
mistake. This was not so much a mistake, but just ignoring the good counsel.
But then you've learned from it, and you've had a lot of good advice for people over the years that hopefully help prevent them from doing
well. Still got some parts of home. I have a hard time letting loose of them. That I had to haul the airplane off. I took my chainsaw to saw it up and haul it to dump because it was delaminated all the way through the cart rooting. It looked from a distance, when I first saw it, I thought, well, I may be able to save it.
Once you got in there, the delamination.
Yeah, it was all over the place. Yeah.
Unfortunate. Hey, Jim, thank you for coming down.
Okay. How do we stretch this out? Oh, my goodness. We stretch this out for 2 hours.
Yeah.
2 hours, 15 minutes. Well,
you've been great, though. Okay. I appreciate you coming down to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club studios here and sharing your wisdom and your stories. This has been absolutely wonderful for me. You've always been somebody in the chapter I looked up to as somebody who's got great knowledge. I hope that people will continue to approach you and ask questions because you've got a wealth of wisdom there that you could easily share. So, and I look forward to seeing you around more and talking to you even more.
Yeah, okay.
And now, chapter news for November 2021. This month's meeting will be held November 9th, starting at 7 p.m. in Hangar 15 at Harvey Field. Again, this meeting is open to anyone who wishes to attend in person, as well as those who want to attend via Zoom. If you are considering attending in person, please note Washington State guidelines for gatherings suggest masks for those attending, whether fully vaccinated or not. The Zoom meeting link will be published in the newsletter. For the latest and most up-to-date information, visit the chapter website or any of the social media pages the chapter maintains, such as Facebook and Instagram. This month's presenter will be entrepreneur, author, and adventurer Robert DeLaurentis. Robert will be talking about his pole-to-pole flight and many of his other flying adventures. An update at our home airport, Harvey Field. The runway rehab project has been completed, and wow, is the runway a treat. I have heard from a reliable source that most of the project went as planned. The second layer did require a thicker coat than originally anticipated, but the end result was well worth all of the trouble. I encourage everyone to come check it out and do their own evaluation. Well, that wraps it up for this month's podcast. I hope you enjoyed our chat with Jim Davison. Spread the word about the Chapter 84 podcast to your friends. It's available for free download on most apps, including Spotify, Apple, and Google. Make sure to hit that like button, subscribe, and file a flight plan for next month's podcast. I encourage everyone to follow EA Chapter 84 on social media apps like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, this has been your host, David Weber, and remember, stay off the brakes. Keep moving forward.